Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Nick Lippis, and welcome to the Built for Trust podcast, where you get to hear from all the folks who are building and shaping AI enterprise infrastructure. Now, let's get right into it with our guests. Hey, James, how are you?
Nick, great to see you. I'm doing well.
God, I'm so happy to talk to you. I know it's taken us a while to kind of schedule this, but you know, I'm glad we're finally on the platform. So, how are things in jolly old London?
Well, it's summer is approaching. The sun's out. It's finally stopped raining. It's been raining here for what feels like months, but the weather's great. You know, summer is starting to approach, so things are great. Thank you for asking.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, actually, we might come back to London this year. You know, it's we're pretty close to that. I'll let you know, if it all kind of clicks, you know, it comes together, you know.
Good. But yeah, it'd be great to see you. Yeah. And exciting times for Ono, right? You know, with the AI conference coming up in Dallas.
I tell you, James, it's really been so much fun, working with the team. And like, we learned a lot in 2023. Last time we were in Dallas, Doug Comer gave a talk on kind of really just kind of an academic perspective about AI that was really well, attended. And also it just, you know, a lot of people were excited about it. Obviously we're living in the, you know, ChatGPT moment, you know, and then in the fall we had Andy Brown and Phil T do a keynote on the second day that really talked about their perspective on the impact of AI in the enterprise marketplace, you know, not in the kind of consumer, you know, space and the whole government space and regulation and stuff like that, but its impact. That was, you know, over the top, you know, and so we asked them to do a track and they said, yeah, I'd love to. And so after our first meeting, we realized this isn't a track. This is just like totally changing everything we're doing. And so that's why we're calling it the AI Networking Summit. You know, we'll probably like in the fall timeframe, we'll start to really put the Onoog name, you know, down on the bottom, you know, so it'll be produced by Onoog and it's still our community, you know, but that's really going to be the focus, moving forward.
And a very prescient talk, I think, Nick, because we're starting to see enterprises really look at how they can reduce their operating costs to start to shift dollars towards investing in AI in their business, and the levels of efficiency gain that enterprises are really looking at in terms of their kind of administrative operational type functions are very significant. And I think, you know, AI and investments in AI, particularly generative, are going to be the next wave of IT spending. It's going to be the IT story for the next half decade.
Yeah, I'm with you, and I want to dive really deep into this, you know, in this discussion. But first, I want to make sure everybody knows you. Like, I know you, James. Like, you know, I've known you for a couple of years. I haven't known you for like decades, you know, but I've known you for a couple of years. We got introduced by Ernest Leffner, who used to work, you know, for you. And so I want to make sure everybody knows who you are. You know, you have this really wonderful career journey and path. So could you share a little bit about it before
we
start?
Because
they hear that, the weight of your words are going to be enormous. So go for it.
So who doesn't like talking about themselves, Nick? So, I was brought up in the UK. I was born in what is, of course, the most beautiful town in England, if not the world, Stamford in Lincolnshire. And I actually started my career. We were just talking about this before you kind of pressed the go live button. I actually started my career as a sound engineer before I went to university, putting on kind of very large concerts, like rigging sound stages and so on. Then I went to university. Wow. I was studying economics at Newcastle up in the north of England. And I started out my career as a programmer working for my dad's software company. And so he was a kind of early adopter of Unix. So I was kind of a Unix System 5 Release 4 kind of I guess you call it a systems admin now or something. But And so I kind of cut my teeth on Perl and Sed and Awk and all those kind of tools that I'm not sure anybody really uses anymore. And COBOL, funnily enough. And then we started to invest in a what was called a fourth generation language, 4GL at the time, called Uniface 4GL. I don't know if it's even still going now. And there was one other large corporation that was using Uniface 4GL that was hiring, which was Walt Disney Pictures. So I left my dad's firm and I went to work for the Walt Disney Studios for a few years, which was just fabulous fun. What a great company, just great people. I worked for people like Don Clark, Sherry Brown, John Kovas, really inspiring, great leaders. And after a while, I moved on. I went to work for JP Morgan, another great company in network operations in London. And I spent a lot of time there, kind of having to build our own network management tools. It sounds kind of crazy now because the tools everywhere.
Off
But
the
at the
shelf,
time, you
yeah.
had to build a lot of your own tools. So we built capacity management tools, usage-based billing systems, network monitoring tools, and so on. And after a while, I got outsourced to a company called CSC, Computer Sciences Corporation,
Oh, yeah.
now part of DXC.
Yeah.
And I spent a few years there in kind of outsourcing network services, mostly for banks. And then eventually kind of headed back to banking myself and went to run networks for Credit Suisse back in, I don't know, 2005. I did that job for a while, moved to Morgan Stanley, did the sort of similar sort of thing there, networks and procurement and cost savings and those sort of things. And then moved to Bank of America, and that's where I met Ernest, or where I met Eunuch, in 2014. And then I left Bank of America about just over a year ago to come join IBM. And I'm in I work for IBM Cloud, and I'm in a role called Cloud Economics. So really looking at the economics of cloud, both as a cloud provider, how we make money, and also how we help to save money for our customers. So it's really interesting, and slightly different venture for me, because I really felt, I spent most of my time in the enterprise, most of my time running, building and running networks. And I met so many great people from the community and so many great people from Ono. You mentioned Andy Brown earlier. Andy and I were former colleagues at Credit Suisse. Andy, in fact, was a predecessor in my role running networks at Bank of America. He ran networks at Merrill Lynch, which of course was acquired by Bank of America. So it's kind of, Phil Teave, an industry legend. So I think it's kind of within the community, we all know each other pretty well. It's just a great bunch of folks. I feel lucky and privileged to have spent my time working with such amazing people, yourself, Ernest, Andy, and so on. It's just great to be talking to you now, Nick. So here I am. So
Awesome.
I'm at IBM in IBM Cloud, learning about
Yeah,
cloud
well,
and
so,
AI.
what I love about your background is that you started off in coding and in software, and that in the kind of earlier part of the kind of computer science kind of development, right? Or the arc of it, and then came into networking, and now we're really coding and software is becoming so important into like the networking infrastructure space as well. So I love that you have both of those backgrounds, and in particular, you have backgrounds, that straddle both the consumer, side of it, and then also the supplier, side of the marketplace, and that's really unique. Really, your backgrounds is pretty, there's a lot of parallels with Andy Brown's, background, as well. So, that's probably why, you guys just seem so
I
smart.
hesitate to compare myself too closely, Nick, because Andy's just smarter than like anybody else, including me.
He is, I tell you, Andy is amazing. I so enjoy working with him, and when I'm actually talking with him, I've got to think hard. And I've got to like, pay attention, to like every word he's saying, and process it as quick as I can. And I love that. It's kind of a challenge. He's he's got this really kind of wealth of experience, and he can articulate it like really, really well. So,
yeah.
Well, let's see. So, I wanted to like kind of draw upon maybe one experience that you shared, and see if that can kind of lead us into like present day. So, you know, when we were in London, I don't know, a couple of years before the pandemic, you gave a presentation around the automation of network infrastructure over at Bank of America. So it was a very large project, you know, that you did. And the results, you know, were, you know, you were hoping for better results. I think that's the way I remember it. You know, if I'm wrong, please correct me. But I think, you know, if you can talk a little bit about that, it would be great, because I think that kind of sets the stage for maybe the gaps that were in the industry at that point in time, and maybe how those gaps are now closing, you know, as we start to kind of really move into like AI infrastructure and AI networking. So,
sure. And it's an absolutely kind of fascinating time, Nick. And I look back over the last few years, because if you look at kind of networking and you compare it to almost any other kind of technology in IT and enterprise IT, it's the one that kind of stayed a bit stuck. If you go back to the kind of compute days, when I started out, and I was back in the 90s, I was working for JP Morgan, you had DEC Baxes and AS400s and Stratus and you know, all these kind of different flavors, you know, there's VMS and different operating systems, the world eventually kind of converged on Unix like infrastructures on Linux, and predominantly Intel and ARM kind of RISC type processes. Yeah. But pretty much if you kind of you're a programmer, you're an SA, you sat in front of a computer screen in the 90s, you had to know that operating system, you had to know those tools. 10 years later, you could sit down pretty much in front of any computer in the world, and it would kind of look the same, right? And the tools and the programming languages and the interface and everything else was going to be pretty familiar to you. That didn't happen in networks. It was proprietary platforms, proprietary operating systems, proprietary CLI-driven, predominantly CLI, command line interface-driven interfaces to networks. And I employed, throughout my kind of career running enterprise networks, hundreds or even thousands of people that were really, really smart, that were really technical, that knew how to build these incredibly complicated systems using all sorts of hieroglyphics that nobody else would understand, with thousands of lines of code that was mostly manually crafted, that if you transposed a couple of characters, like the most complicated problems could occur. I remember one example, the bank I worked for, I won't name them, where we were implementing some new route filters in India, and somebody transposed a couple of characters in about 5,000 lines of code, and it took out ATM machines kind of across the whole bank in a completely different continent. And because it's BGP, there's a more specific route which just happened to be for the bank's entire retail network, that just happened to be a 4G router sitting in a wiring closet somewhere, these unintended consequences were really, really hard to detect. They're really hard to kind of plan out, this kind of manual crafting by really, really experienced, smart people that was still incredibly risky and could go wrong. And as you remember, a few years ago when we first started talking about this large scale automation program that we were working on, again, with my prior employers, we put a lot of money into, it's a big project. It was a combination of a managed services deal that was sort of empowered by a joint investment in the automation. So the concept was really, you know, kind of the provider would take away the operating risk, financial risk for me, and operating risk, because we jointly invest in the automation, and they would effectively guarantee the result for me, because they were also going to operate the network, and we sort of built in the advantages of this automation we were building. And it was kind of naive on my behalf, really, because they were really complicated, hard problems that I thought I could solve that other people much smarter than me had been trying to solve for a long time and hadn't, which was this heterogeneous environment from a design standpoint, from an equipment standpoint. You know, networking is a really simple problem at its heart, which is you want to move packets around primarily. Yeah. You know, I want to move packets from one place to another really quickly and in a losseless securely. Way. and secure. And I want to be able to enforce policy. You know, is this packet allowed to go there? Is it not allowed to go there? You can see that thing and so on. So it's a really simple problem, but it's really, really hard and really expensive to do well. So I thought, you know, by building, automation, which predominantly around kind of understanding state, understanding the configuration of the environment, and being able to orchestrate that environment kind of consistently and centrally, I could solve that problem. And the difficulty was there's so much variation in the kind of configuration. There's so much embedded complexity from, you know, 10 years ago, somebody had a some application in Australia that needed a particular route setup or something, you know, and it got embedded somewhere in all these, you know, in this network underlay. And that guy left the firm and nobody knew it was there anymore. And then you go, you know, upgrade the equipment and something catastrophic breaks and it takes you hours to fix. So what we started to deploy and roll out, it became known as, you know, software defined networks. But what we mean by that is, kind of network systems that had, you know, centralized controllers. And you're sort of moving away from the initial concept of the internet, I suppose, and, you know, distributed network systems that, you know, the control plane and the forwarding plane sit on the same piece of equipment. That in the, you know, there's no centralized control because there's nothing that can go wrong. If you go back to the ARPA days, you know, they're worried about nuclear war and so on. You know, that device is resilient and will survive. Any kind of catastrophic failure, you know, elsewhere in the system. So we kind of move away from that and said, well, as you move to these controllers in software defined networks, like software defined WAN, so, you know, I think the first controller based system we implemented, prior employer was a wireless system. Conrad, in fact, one of a former Oleg
Conrad alum. Big shout Conrad out Menezes, to Conrad.
now at HP, I think, you know, it was Conrad that did a lot of the development work on that system at the bank. And what we found was these kind of incredible gains in efficiency and consistency in our ability to deploy at scale. And I kind of had to take a bit of a step back and think, you know what, it's kind of trying to automate and orchestrate complex legacy systems that have got, you know, all this legacy kind of configuration and code embedded in them. It's really hard and really expensive. And in fact, just kind of coding up a specific use case is much more expensive and much harder than actually kind of ripping out that legacy environment and putting something more modern in. So was I disappointed in that project? A little bit. I mean, it was, I think it was still a, you know, it was a great project to work on. It met its financial goals and so on. But one of the learnings from it was, if we moving to more modern, you know, controller-based networks, software-defined networks, it is, the risk reward trade-off, the risk of when something goes wrong, you go really, really horribly wrong and catastrophically wrong and take your whole data center out, you know, controller failure or something that has happened in a few places. But the advantages from the standpoint of the cost of operation, the configuration, and so on were very significant. And as we start to move into, kind of AI enabling our networks, you've got much more, the data's much more available. You can start to build data lakes, you can start to build up kind of data in a kind of consistent way across your environment. You can start to use AI and machine learning techniques to gain much more insight into what's actually happening in your networks. The whole kind of cost of operation starts coming down.
So let's explore that a little bit. So you mentioned kind of there's the control plane and there's actually the forwarding plane, and both of them have state, information, right? So on the forwarding plane, we have ways in which that state is communicated, whether that is like, SFlow, or SNMP, or proprietary mechanisms or APIs that many companies support. There's no consistency in those logs, though, that are communicated. So maybe there's a canonical, way in which, the industry can gather, but the industry has been reluctant to do that. But there is data there, and there's a huge amount, of data there. All right. And then on the control plane, that's all the configuration state, information within the infrastructure. Different vendors have different ways to kind of communicate that configuration state. So I think on the 10,000 foot level, I see, okay, great. We do have lots of ways in which we can get data that can be aggregated so that the posture of the infrastructure could be assessed, both in terms of maybe availability and any kind of metric that you want to, attach to it. And even security can be layered onto that as well. So you can have a posture of performance, a posture, of how secure, the infrastructure is. And you can actually do that maybe on a per flow basis, as well. And that can be presented to an application. So an application can then, or the infrastructure and the application and, relationship could change, where, there could be policy that is going to be directing how this infrastructure will be able to service that application so that the end user gets this really great experience that's dictated all by kind of policy and conformance to regulations and so forth. I think so. I can see that, but it seems like, once you dive into it, it's almost like the experience that you had, in trying to make that happen. And I'm a little bit worried that, okay, we're kind of assuming there's going to be some, AI pixie dust that's going to be spread all over this, that will solve that, so I'm not sure if you've, as you kind of think about this, will AI be able to actually solve this problem, so that we can have an infrastructure that we have lots of different, like, whether it's an AI orchestrator or a controller, that can actually view a huge amount of data and then, help making decisions, that we'd have to get comfortable with. And then the question there too is that, you mentioned, heterogeneity, or mixed vendor environments. Who's to say that, everyone's going to adopt the same kind of AI, so there might, there could be various different, proprietary AI implementations. And so, like, then all right, how do we deal with that? So, I love the promise, of the world that we're getting into. I'm a little bit concerned about, the human behavior, corporate behavior, that is, it's capitalism, and it's try to preserve your market share and to lock in customers. And if that may slow down, I think what we're hoping to like see achieved here. So I don't know. Any thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, right?
Sorry, there's a lot there. Sorry
So,
about that.
I don't know. I'll try and kind of peel things a little bit back a little bit. It's like
Okay.
when you're looking at kind of data and telemetry and it's kind of a starting point for kind of how you make decisions, how you operate networks and so on. Then, the first kind of point I guess to make is, as we're moving out of a pure sort of enterprise environment into a hybrid environment, some of the infrastructure is not going to be controlled by the enterprise anymore. So I guess that was one of the points you're making about, this heterogeneous kind of environments is, back in the day when you and I probably first started building networks, it was kind of you owned everything. It was you had circuits, yeah. and you had your own data centers, and you kind of controlled the edge and everything else. And now it's kind of, well, you maybe own your own data center and the network within the data center. The transport might well be internet based. So you're running kind of VPNs of some description over public networks. And some of that compute capacity is going to be in the cloud in the form of platform as a service, infrastructure as a service, software as a service, and so on. So you've got these kind of mixed environments that you're working in where you don't necessarily control everything. And also and this is kind of a key problem, I think, for there's a couple of key problems for kind of network people who traditionally run networks. One is the observation point changes. Mm. So in the past, you used to be able to observe, flow across kind of routers and switches. You could put probes and sniffers, and you could span ports and all the rest of it. And you spend a lot of money on buying probes and collecting data. But if you're now encapsulating traffic and encrypting traffic, so even within the data center with protocols like VXLAN and Geneva and so on, then what can you see from a probe that exists at the layer two? It's layer three. I can see some encrypted traffic that's encapsulated in something. That doesn't tell me a lot. Now, from an operational standpoint, when you've got developers and the folks running applications saying, "Well, yeah, tell me what's going wrong with my application. Tell me why my application isn't performing." You could kind of, well, I can't see anything, guys, right? I can just see some encrypted traffic passing between two endpoints. It looks good to me. It's like the 21st century version of I can ping it from here. Right? Which is response back to the developers, sorry, when you had a problem. So, So in a way, you've kind of have almost a shift left of network operations from the folks that are providing the infrastructure to the developers themselves, because applications are going to have to signal their requirements into the infrastructure in some way, because they're going to have to tell, you have to tell the internal network or an external network or an internal infrastructure or external infrastructure what they actually need, what I need in terms of security, what do I need in terms of performance and so on. And that's, and it's sort of, I know I'm kind of, it's a long trail of breadcrumbs, but that's why work such as the, policy as code work that the ONEG is doing is so important, because, we need standardized machine readable ways of encoding policy and setting policy and being able to signal kind of policy requirements to the infrastructure. And so when you start to kind of at least standardize the way in which we describe the environment and the way in which we describe the needs of applications and workloads that are running on our networks, that's the point at which it becomes we enable some of these the promise of AI and machine learning and these kind of new ways of working. If you're having to embed, policy kind of deeply inside kind of configurations in lots of different types of machine, it becomes really hard. And I think the point you made earlier about, if you trace the end-to-end path of some transaction and all the different pieces of equipment that it has to traverse, whether it's firewalls and routers and load balancers and WAFs and everything else, right? You have to encode today. You have to encode that kind of policy all the way through that sort of signal path, and it's really complicated and it's really hard. And provisioning new services, as anybody who runs an enterprise network will tell you, it's kind of figuring out how to get two machines to talk to each other across different zones with different security policies associated with them is kind of hard, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so I think, you know, so a couple of things I kind of gleam from that. One, kind of the shift left, and I think, you know, you're absolutely right. Like, you know, most enterprises own a lot less infrastructure than they used to, you know. And I think the last time we actually did a poll on this is that, like, you know, like 50%, you know, or they're basically saying they own like 50% less of what they used to own, like, you know, 10 years ago. You know, and that's obviously, and that's increasing. So services, you know, around infrastructure. And so, and then it's being able to kind of leverage those services and maybe kind of the AI platforms that they embed into those services.
Yeah. And how do you know when they're going wrong, right? If you can't instrument them yourself, how do I know if somebody else's infrastructure is, you know, is playing up and that's the cause of some, you know, performance degradation or something in my environment? I mean, you know, much more, you've got to be able to, you know, we used to talk about this kind of mean time to innocence in network, right? You know, it's like, how quickly can you prove that the network wasn't the problem of, you know, wasn't causing this problem in terms of application performance? That just got a lot harder. Just got a lot harder, right?
I know. Yeah. So the whole observability, AI observability, you know, becomes like really, really key there. So I think there's, you know, there's that, you know, part of it that will maybe play a component into this. And then, you know, so I'm not sure, like, where do you kind of see kind of hope for that outcome that we were just, you know, talking about, you know, where the infrastructure is able to kind of automate, you know, like almost like, can you have lights out operations, network operations?
Yeah.
And that, I know we talked to, you know, I think the other key piece that you mentioned is the whole policy as code. And so have the application to be able to signal to the infrastructure what its requirements are, you know, what its overall needs are, and then have that infrastructure, you know, maybe, and maybe that gets signaled to an AI orchestrator, and that orchestrator then orchestrates, you know, those policies and, or orchestrates the infrastructure so that it delivers on those policies and it monitors that, you know, as well. You know, so, or maybe this is kind of really where, like, we haven't, like in terms of like really product development, if we think about product development in the whole AI networking space, like right now, I'm kind of thinking there's like probably three phases of this. And maybe this kind of ties into this discussion, James. Like the first one that we're seeing right now is kind of like the Gen AI products, right? And these are kind of existing products that have been in the marketplace, but now they have kind of a AI you know, kind of module or interface, you know, that makes the operations of them a little bit easier, be able to answer questions, you know, associated with them, get support and so forth. And I think that's really useful and that's helpful. Then I think, you know, the next phase, and actually we're going to see this phase like coming up actually at this ONUG, we're going to see, you know, I know one company in particular, it's going to actually deliver an AI firewall. So it's like a rethinking of the firewall from the ground up, you know, and try to do away with ACLs and all the rules and all the toil associated, you know, with all those rules. So then, so I think that's kind of like the second phase. I'm kind of thinking that's a pre-AGI, you know, products, right? So, so we have kind of GAA products that are, everyone is now adding to their products, you know, today. And then I think, you know, there's the beginnings of like kind of, you know, an AGI kind of products themselves. So these are kind of self-contained within that particular product. And then, so that could be kind of a pre-AGI. And then there's kind of the AGI infrastructure. I'm not sure how long that gap is. And that's when you actually have learning, communication, synchronization between products that deliver a better, a larger effect. So I kind of view that as like full service driving, like with Teslas today, you know? So it's like, like I've been driving a Tesla for a decade, right? So it's like all of the cars, you know, I've been providing, I know I've been providing video snippets, you know, to Tesla for like the last, like at least 6 or 7 years or so. And so large neural net, you know, and now that's kind of delivering a service where the cars can, you know, be pretty much autonomous. You know, it's like, you know, I downloaded the new version of 12.3 this weekend, so I've been using it and it is remarkably better, but it's still not perfect, you know. But it's like from like, you know, like basically from 2016, it's like night and day, you know. So anyway, so
I think you know, the game changer is when, you know, you get the network effect, right? You're driving along in your Tesla and it's talking to the Tesla in front, they run into a truck or something, right? It only have to be within line of sight. You know, your Tesla should know there's an accident up ahead and put the brakes on or reroute you or something else. So it's, you know, when all of these systems start talking to each other and sharing information and optimizing traffic across the entire system, that's you know, rather than as an individual, autonomous system, that's when we're going to see the real benefits, right?
I'm so with you. Like, I get a little taste of that today. So, for example, like, my Tesla will geomark, where there are big potholes. So if I go over that, before I go over that, it'll increase the suspension system, my car. So like, okay, I'm not going to bottom out, when I hit that. And I think, wow, that's like so cool. That's, I love that, kind of automated feature, there. But yeah, for them to be able to kind of communicate to each other so that, you can now, like right now, okay, yeah, when there's traffic, if there's traffic, it'll, divert you. But like, it would also be good to know is, okay, is there an accident in the left lane or the right lane? And so then it could like, okay, decide it's going to move over to like, to avoid or go into the, yep, the greatest flow.
Or apply the brakes, right?
Oh, well, yeah. Well, you think first. Sure. So I think that, so going back to like our industry, I'm thinking that we're kind of in the kind of the Gen AI phase of the, of products. We're going to start seeing, products that have their own kind of, embedded AI. And so I think we're going to have whole new categories or existing products like, okay, AI routers, AI firewalls, AI load balances, AI PCs, for sure, that are coming from AMD and Intel and Broadcom and, and others. So we're starting to kind of embed AI into all of these and applications, supply chain, right? Or dependency map, right?
Nick, I wonder, I think I'd like, are we going to see AI solving kind of legacy problems? Are we going to see AI reinventing the kind of paradigm? What I mean by that is kind of, hey, somebody comes out with a great kind of Gen AI sort of, code generation type application, which will allow you to, much more efficiently generate error-free code to certain your existing network systems. Hey, I'm going to be great at writing, Cisco CLI to orchestrate my current environment. Mm-hmm. Or are we going to see, and this is where I think we're going to go, is we kind of, we'll not abandon the past because we sort of there's billions of dollars of an installed base of kind of legacy equipment. But I think the exciting developments in AI are when we'll move past that paradigm. And because if you think, again, if you go back to what do we do in networks? If I want to build a network today, we have to have all these kind of network architects and network engineers, and they, kind of design all these configurations and test it and everything else. Whereas really what I want to say is like, here's my business need. My business need is I want to connect these two places, these two systems or multiple systems. I want to set a security policy, and maybe I want to set a kind of a performance policy and I require certain performance characteristics. So the need is really simple, and I need to operate it and monitor it and make sure it's meeting my needs. But it's a really simple problem that requires lots of money and complexity and talent to solve. So, I think if I'm looking at, network and security from a kind of connectivity standpoint, there's kind of, we'll start seeing more ML become more ubiquitous in, monitoring, self-monitoring, self-analyzing, self-correcting, kind of networks, predicting network failures, identifying inefficiencies and proactively maintaining the environment, all those other things. Then I think, kind of we'll get more into traffic analysis and prediction. So that the sort of networks will become more adaptive in terms of managing bandwidth and reducing bottlenecks and improving user experience and so on. And, I think we see, I always think we're going to bottom out on the amount of traffic we put in the network. And we never do this. And people always find new ways of putting huge amounts of bandwidth, right? You know, like who'd have predicted prior to COVID that we would all be sitting in, you know, in the next room as each other in the same office on a WebEx or a Zoom chat rather than having a meeting in an actual meeting room. I mean, it's just kind of crazy. We're using video now to talk to one another. Right?
I find meetings without, like, you know, Zoom was like so like 1990s.
Yeah. It's weird. Nobody has a conference call anymore. Yeah, but before the pandemic, I mean, I didn't always turn my video on, right? I mean, you look at things like. These kind of link state protocols that we have that form the kind of fundamental basis of routing decisions in networks. You know, it's like I have a cost on a particular route, and then, you know, it's that link up or down, and you know, you have these routing algorithms that figure out how I'm going to send traffic. You know, and that feels like a kind of a yesterday's paradigm, right? As we bring AI into automating kind of route selection and traffic management and network performance based on real time conditions, you know, this is sort of the promise, not quite there yet, of SD-WAN. I'm going to measure in real time what the performance characteristics of any kind of network path is, and I'll figure out how to best optimize my traffic. And again, I think, you know, that leads into kind of these kind of QoS type enhancements, I guess, where we dynamically, adjusting sort of quality of service based on the network conditions, application requirements. And if we're in a world of constraint, you know, we've got constrained bandwidth or something, you know, it's kind of, you know, we're doing more intelligent decisions based on how requirements are signaled to the network. And I think but I think when you mentioned AI enabled firewalls, that's the kind of really interesting thing move to me, because anybody that's run a large enterprise network where you've got multiple different kind of secure internal security boundaries, you know, external is kind of almost easier to deny or unless established or something, right? But you can have literally hundreds of thousands of internal firewall rules that are sitting in, you know, right across the infrastructure. It's really hard to keep track of. It's really hard to manage. And then you kind of have things that go wrong because you have your information security guys will say something like, oh, we've got a new policy that if a firewall rule isn't triggered every quarter or something, you know, then it's considered to be a legacy firewall rule and gets turned off. And then you realize it's like when you have a DR situation, you had a firewall rule that was only going to be used in a disaster recovery, that thing hadn't happened or hadn't been tested and the rule got disabled and then something broke and the failover didn't work because, you know, automatically aged out that firewall. I mean, you have to deal with these things all the time. So I think, you know, if you move to a different paradigm in security, it says, you know, like I can look at all these flows and I can understand the business logic and I look at these flows within the enterprise, you know, I'm really looking for anomalous behavior or stuff that doesn't make sense. So I'm not looking to say, you know, is this IP address going and talking to this IP address, and have I got a rule that says it's allowed to versus, have I got unusual patterns of behavior? And, you know, I consciously avoided mentioning, my current employer, IBM, and some of the work we're doing, but I mentioned there was one thing I did want to mention, which was, in our storage division where we're looking at malware and we're saying, you know, if you build into the storage platform the ability to detect malware and prevent malware, you know, there's an extra layer of defense. And I was thinking, I was with our storage guys, we were talking about this product they're building. And I was thinking, you know, why didn't anybody else ever think of that? You know, it's kind of, you've got some code sitting on a hard drive and it says somebody's just trying to encrypt me, right? Should they be allowed to do that or not, right? The network that sees everything should be able to determine what's a normal pattern of behavior, what's an abnormal pattern of behavior. Should I allow this to go ahead? You know, should somebody in this part of the business ever talk to somebody in this part of it? You know, should an air conditioning unit you know, ever talk to a payment system and try and initiate a payment transaction? Well, clearly not if you're a human being, but if you're a network, it's like, hey, like, am I, are these two subnets allowed to talk to each other? Yeah, you know, fine, I don't care. So
yeah, I know. Yeah.
I think
there's no consciousness there.
I think this is going to be really interesting shift in that whole kind of security landscape.
That's really, you know, interesting. You know, James, like the concept that you mentioned is so salient. You know, I want to make sure like we capture it. You know, and that is that will we apply AI to existing infrastructure, or will we basically repeat what we did in the cloud era? Where the cloud era, they kind of just redefined, you know, what does infrastructure mean? What does it mean to kind of do applications? Are we basically doing that, you know, again? So we'll have kind of AI first companies, like we had cloud first, you know, companies, and that there'll be some that will apply, you know, AI to kind of existing infrastructure because you'll be able to get, you know, efficiencies, whether that's, you know, kind of OpEx, you know, reductions, you know, or just increased efficacy. Maybe of your security platforms, but maybe that's really right. You know, is that like I'm kind of viewing the AI ecosystem as four different layers. You know, on the bottom are the chips. The second is the infrastructure. The third is kind of foundational, which is becoming more and more open sourced and commoditized. And then the fourth layer are the applications. And the applications, you know, we know about them mostly from kind of the commercial side of it, like Midjourney and ChatGPT and Gronk and, you know, and others. But the real AI, enterprise AI applications really haven't hit yet, you know, and maybe that's, you know, once that layer, and that's where a ton of the money is going to be. The money is really in that layer and then also the chips and infrastructure, and the chip one is really dominated by NVIDIA, as we know, and the infrastructure is kind of dominated by NVIDIA, you know, also, but there's a broad range of companies in the infrastructure space. That's so salient, you know, that is so insightful.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. That's probably
and
right.
Again, I think, Nick, there's it's kind of a paradigm shift that we haven't, I don't think we kind of see it coming. I think how dramatic it's going to be, which is, for me, is how developer roles are going to change. And, you know, potentially we're going to see a shift from coding to training, right? You know, so you've seen, I think we're already starting to see these kind of huge improvements in developer productivity by using kind of generative AI to generate computer code. And for enterprises that kind of disallow that or haven't figured out, you know, which tools to use or how to take advantage of that, they're going to be left behind in the dust because you know, the productivity of developers is like orders of magnitude better with Gen AI to kind of write the building blocks of any piece of code they want to write. And, but I think there's, you know, that's kind of phase one. Phase two is going to be, you know, will the role of developers shift more towards the kind of selecting, training, fine-tuning AI models, you know, as these kind of pre-built AI services become more prevalent, you know, these enterprise AI applications you talked about, Nick, that, you know, it's really about, you know, how do you train them on your enterprise data and on your enterprise kind of business process rather than, hey, look, I'm going to go write myself an, I don't know, accounting system or, you know, a customer service system or, you know, a factory control system or something else. You know, it's more about, you know, I'm going to take some AI service and I'm going to train it and let it loose on my enterprise.
Yeah, that's so, so interesting because, like, you know, we've all been, all the numbers are kind of pointing that, you know, this transition is going to be, you know, multiples times faster than the internet revolution, you know, was, and especially around the developer side of it. So all of a sudden, if the developers do make that shift, which they probably will, and you're seeing this, you know, you're with IBM, like IBM, you freaking had Watson for like, you know, what, 20 years, you know? So it's like, you got like this amazing.
And, but you know, look what's happened to our share price, right? You know, IBM is a major beneficiary of this, enterprise, you know, of the AI way, because I think, and I hope, and it's one of the reasons I joined them, you know, they're seen as a you know, a company that has the either the security and privacy and you know, kind of operational capabilities to deliver very, very critical workloads into large enterprises. And there's not many of those firms around, and I think they're going to be major beneficiaries. And we start to see, look at Microsoft. Like they're just going gangbusters, right?
It's like crazy. $3 trillion, market cap is like, good for them. It's like, they're delivering a need, in the marketplace. But if you look at both Microsoft and also IBM, both have deep relationships with the enterprise marketplace. Google, not so much, very much more consumer, based company. Amazon, retail, based company that did really great in the cloud infrastructure. We really still waiting for them to kind of like really have a major offering, into the AI space, but really when you think about the big cloud providers, because I think there's probably really what Microsoft and also with IBM is probably benefiting from is that both companies understand kind of cloud economics and cloud delivery models. Both have deep relationships and trust. Trust is the key word, in the large enterprise, marketplace as well. And so as we're kind of looking towards this new disruption and this transition, you kind of go to the people that you trust, and the companies that you trust, obviously.
Nick, it's a matter of public record, but if you look at the investments that we're making in IBM Cloud, the capital investments we're making, they are very much driven by a couple of major strategies for us. What's the next AI? So our enterprise AI platform, and our push into a kind of a secure cloud for regulated industries. So we're building a business around the fact that we can deliver very complex, very critical workloads in the most trustworthy, private way, but at the same time, building an AI infrastructure that large enterprises, and particularly in the regulated industries, can trust will meet their needs and the regulators' needs for privacy and security and availability. Because this is kind of we're in unknown territory now, right? It's like, can you trust your AI provider with your data, or are they going to train their models on it and sell it to someone else? I think if you look at the sort of the creative arts, that's a really significant kind of ethical and business and IP problem for them. It's like, who owns artistic content? If you recreate somebody's voice or their look or just the style of their writing or something else. Now, if you're a large enterprise, do you want models being trained on your own kind of trade secrets that could potentially be sold to someone else? So, I think, and I know we're kind of at the end of our short time together to chat, Nick, but this is a fascinating area, I think, that is going to shape a lot of the debate around deployment of AI in the enterprise over the next few years.
Yeah, well, you definitely influenced my thinking, around it. I was really kind of focusing more on existing infrastructure and how to make that better. And that, I'm sure there's a component, to the marketplace that's going to be there. But now I'm really going to start to like really focus on, okay, AI first, because the acceleration.
If it's not AI enabled, it's too hard to retrofit it. You know what? And you're going to be stuck with that legacy environment that costs you a fortune to maintain. You still need to start thinking about, forklift that stuff out. And instead of employing 1,000 people to go around your computer network, like I've done it some other old jobs of mine, do I need just 20 smart people that know how to build AI-enabled infrastructures?
Yeah.
And then it runs itself.
Well, there is the now, the current saying, it's that AI will not take your job away, but it's people with AI skills who will, So it's like, get skilled up. So listen, before we go, I hope you're okay with this. I got to bring this up because like it was such a great story that you shared with me once, you know, and it was like in one of your previous, you know, roles. So like, so just like, you know, so the audience kind of knows is that, you know, you had, you know, domain over this massively large, you know, budget, like, you know, close to about $1 billion a year. And we won't mention like which company. And you were treated and you used the term like a king of a small country. You know, so it was, you know, and I love that.
Yeah,
story.
I'm on the other side now. I'm trying to sell things to people, Nick. It's like, believe me, it's like I don't even get bought a cup of coffee anymore.
I know. Well, that's really what I wanted to, like, you know, get your opinion on. It's like that is a very difficult transition to make. You know, it's like, you know, from being a king of a small country, you know, to all of a sudden now people aren't returning your phone calls. You know, it's like that's a humbling, you know, experience. I've experienced that, you know, a couple of times, you know, in my career. So I just wanted to, like, you know, ask you, okay, well, you know, are you happier now? You know, was that transition like a delight? Like, oh my God, thank God I don't have that anymore.
It was,
you know, it
was.
Or was it just, you know, an adjustment?
It's an adjustment. You know, I work for a great company now, an iconic company in our industry. But I think, It's. I wasn't expecting you to bring it up, but I remember making the comment. But I think it's salient though, because if you look at the way in which large enterprise infrastructure managers are kind of treated, you know, it's you've got very large budgets, you're very important customers, and the incumbents have got very deep relationships, and it's kind of a scary move to something new, and. You know, frankly, there's a lot of internal resistance within large enterprises. Mainly, I think because of risk. You don't want to put your enterprise at risk by adopting new technology. But you know, I think people running large infrastructures have got to kind of sit back sometimes and say, hey, look, I've got these long-standing kind of cozy relationships with these legacy infrastructure companies. Is it the right, you know, is it still the right thing? Can I trust them to move into these new technology areas? Or do I need to really start researching and piloting and embracing, you know, some of these new technologies? Because I think they're going to come out of entirely new providers, out of new companies, not necessarily out of some of the legacy infrastructure companies. I think they're too wedded to the past.
It's like a great way to kind of turn that story around into present day and to folks who are still in those roles that you had for so long. This was like so
Nick,
much
it's
fun.
It's been great to talk to you, you know. Lovely to see you. Hopefully we'll see each other in Dallas. Who knows?
I hope so. No, Jim, thanks so much. Everybody, thanks for plugging in. I hope you enjoyed the discussion with James. Okay. Thanks, James. Okay.